rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falterradio. Der russische Krieg gegen die Ukraine verläuft nicht nach Plan. Präsident Putin muss versuchen, durch eine Teilmobilmachung die Rückschläge seiner Streitkräfte an der Front wettzumachen. Es ist ein unausgesprochenes Eingeständnis der Schwäche, denn der Angriff auf das Nachbarland ist gegenüber der eigenen Bevölkerung als Spezialoperation bezeichnet worden. In vielen Teilen Russlands gibt es Widerstand dagegen, dass Söhne, Väter oder Brüder als Kanonenfutter in einen völlig unnötigen Krieg geschickt werden. Ein Kriegsherr, der scheitert, kann nachgeben, er kann verhandeln, er kann versuchen, ein Arrangement mit dem Gegner zu suchen. Der russische Präsident tut genau das Gegenteil. Er eskaliert den Konflikt durch den völkerrechtswidrigen Anschluss der besetzten ukrainischen Gebiete an Russland und der Drohung mit Atomwaffen. Die nächsten Wochen könnten für das Schicksal Wladimir Putins entscheidend sein, vermutet die britische Aufdeckerjournalistin Catherine Belton. Catherine Belton war mehrere Jahre lang Korrespondentin der Financial Times in Moskau. Mit ihrem Buch Putins People, auf Deutsch Putins Netz, hat sie Furore gemacht. In einer Wiener Vorlesung im Gespräch mit Tessa Schischkowitz seziert Catherine Belton hochaktuell die geheimen Machtstrukturen des Kreml und Putins Weg zum Krieg.
We unheard Vladimir Putin's words at the Kremlin on illegally annexing 15% of Ukraine's territory. We all heard the implicit threat in his claim that the United States had created the precedent for a nuclear strike when it bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. We all heard his diatribe against what he called the colonialism of the West. These were words of blackmail and intimidation, and they are among the few levers Putin has left as he's increasingly isolated. They are levers he's resorted to as he runs out of options for his presidency. When I began work on Putin's people a long time ago now, in 2013, I was seeking to examine why Putin operated the way he did, why it was he'd taken control of the commanding heights of the Russian economy, and how he'd been able to accumulate so much power. The answer to many of these questions lay in his roots in the KGB, an organization that had never really gone anywhere, that had lurked in the background and maintained its networks even in the 90s when Boris Yeltsin had appeared to take Russia on a bold new democratic path. The answers to these questions lay in a KGB worldview that still regarded the West as the main adversary, and therefore regarded it critical that only loyal allies control the country's cash flows. They also lay in a modus operandi which was first honed in the KGB when they sought to funnel cash through frontmen and intermediaries into influence campaigns to corrupt officials and undermine and disrupt the main adversary in the West. Only the difference between Putin's actions and those of the KGB in the 70s and 80s was that Putin, in taking control of the Russian economy that had already made the transition to the market, essentially had hundreds of billions of dollars at his command and the ability to cause much more chaos. These conclusions were disturbing. They indicated Putin and many of his former KGB allies in the Kremlin that surrounded him were still locked in a Cold War zero-sum thinking. This conviction grew during the time that I was writing the book, as first of all, Putin seized Crimea and then launched his proxy war to take over Donetsk and Lugansk in East Ukraine. It seemed ever more important to understand this modus operandi as we began to see the Kremlin funneling cash to the far left and far right political parties in Europe and the US as he began to seek to disrupt the stability of our democracies here. However, I never imagined that they would go so far as to take the road we see today. Until February the 24th this year, Putin had always sought to maintain at least some degree of deniability whenever he trod roughshod over international law. He always sought to act in a covert way. In annexing Crimea, he didn't admit that the Russian troops had been there until after the referendum had gone through and it was already a fait accompli. And there, too, among the largely Russian-speaking population, there was actual real support for joining Russia. Putin was able to annex it without barely even firing a shot. Most of the elite in Moscow expected Putin to continue to act in a similar, limited way in Ukraine this year. Most of the Moscow elite believed he would limit his action to recognizing the independence of Donetsk and Lugansk, because de facto, for the last 8 years, they'd been independent anyway. It would be enough to continue a quasi-confrontation with the West without imposing devastating repercussions on his economy and on relations. And in this way, he could continue to prop up his own ratings. But Putin ripped off the mask. He believed the West was now weak enough that he could murder civilians in plain sight and somehow get away with it. He sought to take over a country where even in the East, a majority would view the arrival of Russian troops as an occupation. So how did we get here? Part of the answer lies in Putin's past in the KGB. His continuation of the KGB mindset, the resorting to the knee-jerk habits, a modus operandi of a past he never cast off and increasingly turned to the longer his presidency progressed. The other part, the escalation of this last year, is almost an accident of history, hubris, and horrible miscalculation. It lies in Putin's own personal ruthlessness and isolation in the pandemic, when even his closest advisors had to quarantine for 2 weeks before they got to see him. And it lies in the fact that the longer he was in power, the more he became surrounded by yes men who feared telling him anything other than what he wanted to hear. So I will deal first with the clear signs that brought us here, with Putin's roots in the KGB and the networks we often overlooked. What did we miss when all these years we were seeking justifications for Putin's behavior and believing the more he integrated with Western markets, the more he and his corporate elite would begin to follow the Western rules-based order? Putin's road to war in many ways began in Dresden. Then Putin was serving in the mid-80s as a mid-ranking KGB officer. He was the chief liaison between the Stasi and the KGB. We always thought, and it was often described, that Putin's time in Dresden had been a sign that he was an absolute nobody in the KGB. Dresden was seen as a backwater, far away from the main theater in Berlin. Putin himself publicly derided his work there as nothing but shuffling papers. He told interviewers on the eve of his presidency that his work there was so boring that he put on pounds in weight because there was nothing to do there but to drink beer. But there was no photographic evidence of Putin ever gaining any weight. And if you scratch the surface, Dresden was actually an important hub for some of the KGB and the Stasi's most important covert operations. First of all, it was a hub for technology smuggling to try and get Western technology into the East past embargoes. Robotron, the electronics plant there, it had already cloned the IBM. To conduct these operations, Putin worked closely with a star Stasi officer known as Matthias Warnig, who we might know today as the chairman of Nord Stream. He was a hotshot then. He'd been able to recruit at least 20 Western agents to steal Western technology. To do so, in those days, the KGB and the Stasi were expert in planting compromising materials. They would lure Western businessmen to the city's only hotel for foreigners and then secretly film them with prostitutes. Dresden was also such a backwater that it became an important hub for a more dangerous operation. A Stasi defector has spoken about how Putin was a handler for a notorious neo-Nazi who helped stoke the rise of the far right in Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall. A former member of the left-wing terror group, the Red Army faction, otherwise known as the Baader-Meinhof group, has spoken about how Dresden became a meeting point for members of that group. How they would meet with Putin there and other members of the KGB, and there they would receive not orders directly, but just suggestions on future targets. And there they could also provide the KGB and the Stasi with lists of weapons and the cash they needed, which would then be miraculously delivered to them. Dresden was chosen for these meetings precisely because it was such a backwater. So Dresden was also a place where Putin and the foreign intelligence chief of the Stasi began preparing for the fall of the communist bloc. Members of the foreign intelligence community, they could see the writing was on the wall for communism, that the Eastern Bloc could not compete with the West militarily or economically. So they were preparing for perestroika and the transition to the market. They knew it was going to be rocky, so they were trying to preserve what they could. In those days, in Dresden, a man named as a Stasi agent by the German Bundestag, though, of course, he denies it himself, was very active. This man was an Austrian named Martin Schlaff. He was given tens of millions of Deutschmarks in contracts, which have been cited by the German Bundestag, to smuggle in Western technology past embargoes to build what was going to be East Germany's most expensive hard disk plant in the nearby Thuringen. But the technology never arrived, and the plant was never built. Instead, the funds were siphoned into an array of front companies in Liechtenstein and Singapore. Many of them, including Schlaff's business empire in Vienna, were staffed by former Stasi officers. Herbert Kuller, the head of Stasi foreign intelligence in Dresden, went to work as an advisor to Schlaff in Vienna after the collapse of communism. So they were trying to preserve their influence and intelligence networks, even then in the 80s before the fall. And in a sign, they were able to preserve the power of these networks. After Putin came to the presidency, Schlaff reemerged. He was head of a crucial cog in a Gazprom intermediary involved in selling gas to markets in Central and Eastern Europe. This was part of a network known as Centrex, known in at least one instance for involvement in funneling kickbacks through murky gas deals to corrupt and buy off officials in the West. One such deal was exposed by the Italian parliament in 2005 when Gazprom agreed to sell gas through a murky intermediary that was part owned by Schlaff Centrex and part owned by a close friend of Silvio Berlusconi. This close friend of Berlusconi was to get a share of an expected $1 billion in expected annual revenues. Italian MPs believed the money was going to end up with Berlusconi himself, and so they stopped the deal in its tracks. Unfortunately, there were many more deals like that which we never got to find out about. So it was no wonder then that Putin and his comrades back in the 80s were anxious to make sure no trace remained of their activities when the collapse of the Eastern Bloc came faster than they expected. When protesters began to gather outside the KGB villa in Dresden some weeks after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Putin and his KGB comrades were stuffing their files into the furnace there so fast that the furnace burst. It was then that a key moment occurred for Putin. Putin was so worried about the encroaching protesters that he called for backup from the nearby Soviet military base. The answer he got then was to remain with him ever since. And unfortunately, it was to drive many of the actions that we are seeing today. When he rang, he was told by the officer on duty that we can't do anything without Moscow, and Moscow is silent. Putin has spoken about what a devastating moment this was for him. The outposts of empire were being given up, and these words seemed to reverberate forever in his head. He later told an interviewer that business of Moscow is silent. I got the feeling then that the country no longer existed. The Soviet Union had lost its position in Europe. I wanted something different in its place to rise up. But nothing different was proposed. That's what hurt. They just dropped everything and went away. And this has remained with Putin ever since. Putin and his men, however, continued to make great efforts to preserve what they could of their networks, of their traditions and communications. You could see signs of this in Putin's activities in St. Petersburg. There, he worked as deputy mayor, and though he was working for a great Democrat, Anatoly Sobchak, who was the city's mayor, Putin's job was to liaise between the mayor's office and the city's security services. They were all his former allies from the Leningrad KGB, and there they were to prove their ruthlessness. St. Petersburg was then overrun by an outbreak of organized crime. But instead of warring with them, Putin and his KGB allies turned to them. They decided to join hands in business with them to take over the city's most strategic assets, its seaport, its oil terminal, and its oil distribution network. Organized crime was to act as foot soldiers for the KGB. Now, this was something that horrified a senior KGB officer from Moscow, that Putin and the St. Petersburg KGB would be so ruthless to acquire and control power that they'd join hands with this very violent and terrible organized crime group. This Moscow KGB officer had been thinking of joining a business with them. But when they forged an alliance with the Tambov group, the city's most powerful group, he walked away. And he told me that this was a very telling facet of Putin's rule. The St. Petersburg KGB, according to him, were the most ruthless of all. They came from Russia's second city, and they perceived themselves to be less well-educated than their smoother colleagues in Moscow. To put it short, they had an inferiority complex, and this meant that they would do anything to acquire and preserve their power. And unfortunately, we're now all feeling the repercussions of that in the way that Putin and his KGB allies from St. Petersburg now run Russia. Other KGB men from Moscow, such as Yevgeny Primakov, the former foreign spy master, who at one point was also a candidate to take over as president, he would never have ridden roughshod over the rules of the international order in the way Putin and his men have. So these were all facets of Putin's past career that many in the West should have noticed as a cautionary note as we welcome Russian cash into our markets and increased our energy dependency, not just in Austria, but also in London and across markets in Europe and the US. We all believed in euphoria and naivety after the end of the Cold War that all that remained was for Russia to integrate with us, that the more Russian companies that listed their shares here, the more they would have to adapt to our governance and corporate standards. But this was to ignore the fact that the KGB clique in the Kremlin saw capitalism and Western integration as a means of increasing their soft power and as a means of subverting the West. The more Russian cash, often some of it untraceable, the more opportunity there was to deploy it to buy off and corrupt officials here, to weaken and confuse our thinking about who exactly was running the Kremlin. This was also to ignore the fact that many of the once independent oligarchs were in fact no longer oligarchs, but hostage to Putin's Kremlin. Once Putin had arrested and jailed and taken over the company of Russia's one-time richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the remaining Russian billionaires knew they had to follow Kremlin orders if they were to hold on to their fortunes. They had to share part of their cash with the Kremlin and spend it on the Kremlin's strategic agenda.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of them even told me, he said, look, if I get a call from the Kremlin saying, spend $1 billion or $2 billion on this or that strategic project, I can't refuse. I have to comply. So this meant that the companies coming to the West were not driven only by self-interest, but by a KGB agenda, which called on them to acquire soft power and influence here, such as through buying football clubs, perhaps, in London. As we sought to make money through being on the winning side, the Kremlin, which controlled the law courts and the Russian economy, we forgot about and ignored perhaps any other darker side. We didn't want to see that ultimately this could undermine our own security. Now in the last 2 years, now that Putin has cemented his control over all levers of power, Putin and the men around him became so paranoid about all the nefarious acts they'd committed on the way to accumulating so much power. They believed they couldn't afford for Putin to step down. Now Putin has been consumed by his role in history. In isolation during the pandemic, he became ever more under the sway of his most hawkish advisors from the St. Petersburg KGB. Any remaining more liberal pragmatist of the administration has been shut out. Chief among these advisors now is Nikolai Patrushev, the Security Council Secretary, who has led Putin down some of the darkest paths of his presidency. At the infamous Security Council meeting in the days before Putin launched the war, Patrushev basically told Putin what to do. He told him that the US had forced the Ukrainian population down a path of confrontation in East Ukraine, and that the US was seeking to use Ukraine to undermine Russia. He said that Russia had to preserve its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Putin, too, had been told only what he wanted to hear by his own federal security services, who inflated his expectations about how easy it would be to take Kiev in a matter of days, that Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine, would run and hand over power at the first sight of Russian troops. And when you're under increasingly authoritarian rule, when you have to wait 2 weeks in quarantine before you see your leader, you only want to tell him what he wants to hear, to make sure your standing is shored up. So these were the fatal miscalculations of Putin's war. And in his belief, too, that the West would be too weak, too corrupted and undermined to stand up and defend its values and Ukraine in the way it has. Now Putin has been repeatedly forced to switch his tactics. First, when Kiev failed to fall, he was forced to concentrate his forces on taking the east. And now, after months of attrition, he's run out of resources. and he's been forced into sending his own population to hold on to territory gained in the East. This is something I am told by Moscow insiders that he never wanted to do. It was a choice that he never wanted to make. Essentially, he is putting a bomb under his own rule. These are reservists who will not be able to launch any offenses to take more territory. They will simply not be well trained enough. They're there only to hold on to the territory already taken and then hope that somehow Western unity will crumble over the winter. This is Putin's only remaining gambit now. We've seen the first signs that Putin hopes to intensify this hybrid war against the West. First, he seeks to frighten us into submission with his nuclear saber rattling. Then he hopes to incite protests over a winter of higher energy costs and inflation. His gambit is only just beginning. But it's clear these tactics will fail. Putin instead has only undermined the security of his own position. Putin's legitimacy and support from Russia's elite rests on his popularity. That's already plummeted now that Russians have to risk their own lives in this war. Russians never wanted to have to fight themselves. If Ukraine continues to take Russian territory, I'm told by one senior Moscow insider, his position will become untenable. There are those within Russia's own security services, within foreign intelligence and elsewhere, who see Putin's actions as deeply damaging now to their own country. They were willing to bear it while Putin was acquiring territory in the East, but now that's being threatened, and now that hundreds of thousands of Russian men are to be sent to die, it's no longer the case. They were willing to bear it too while they believed they had the support of China and India against the West, but Russia clearly no longer has this support. And Putin's actions and the targeting of ethnic minorities for my mobilization are now the main threats to Russia's territorial integrity. Putin is the main threat to Russia. There are patriots of their country who see Russia's integration in the West as crucial for Russia's ability to continue to compete with the West and not with this status of international pariah. The West may face challenging times, but the deep impact of sanctions on the Russian economy means Putin is facing even more challenging ones. Only if Western unity holds firm can these threats and blackmail be ended. Otherwise, members of the Moscow elite believe that after Ukraine, Putin's attention will turn to other targets in Europe, the Baltic states, and then elsewhere. Thank you so much for your attention.
I sometimes wish your book would have come out 10 years ago and we would have known so much that we didn't know then. And many people also, I think, didn't want to know because it was such a threatening thought that everything would go wrong with Russia. But here we are at this very, very difficult moments now in the history of Europe where a nuclear war is not completely something out of the past, but might be in our future. I would like to talk to you about the question if Putin, at the time you described it now, in Dresden, when he was engaged in Operation Lutsch, the Sunbeam, the Sonnenstrahl, when he was setting up this network to preserve these Soviet structures and to preserve basically the funds. If that was done on his own behalf, or if he was had someone, handlers in Moscow who told him what to do, so was he the small man at the end of it, or was it his initiative?
I think it was certainly not his initiative. He wasn't senior enough, of course, to be in any way behind that. That belonged to much more senior figures than him in foreign intelligence in Moscow. but he happened to be part of the foreign intelligence apparatus then, and he was in Dresden. And we've seen from some of the archives from the Stasi that then he had this role as a party secretary to Hans Modrow, who was the leader of the SED in Dresden. And he was somebody who'd been very much viewed by the Soviets as a potential successor to Erich Honecker. They thought he would be a safer pair of hands. So it's possible that Putin, in this role as party secretary to Honecker, had some role in trying to cultivate what these progressive elements of Soviet foreign intelligence he saw as the key task. They were trying to create new networks of politicians that they could continue to rely on even after the fall of the communist bloc. They wanted to make sure they still had agents of influence in place even after any collapse of their hold. Because they knew, I mean, there were quite senior members of the foreign intelligence community in the Soviet Union who really understood that the writing was on the wall for communism, that they couldn't continue really to compete with the West economically or militarily, that they had to reform, they had to launch perestroika, they had to launch glasnost. I guess what happened was that the transition, the reform process, sped out of their control because the fall of the wall came much faster than they anticipated. But it's certainly the case that they were trying very hard to reach out to sort of secondary level politicians in Germany and elsewhere so that they would have a network of agents that they could continue to tap after the fall. And as I mentioned, they were also trying to create networks of cash, such as the one that Schlaf created through his fake contracts for the hard disk plant, so that they could still have money to run their networks.
Does it astonish you that the whole story of Martin Schlaf that you found quite obvious is not very much discussed, for example, in Austria? I mean, should there be, in your view, more of an investigation also in everything that went on in the past 30 years there?
You know, I think there have been some investigations, but mostly by foreign journalists, and also the German Bundestag in the 90s did conduct a very thorough investigation of his activities then. And then there was an Israeli newspaper which also wrote very thorough reports on his activities and his ties with Ariel Sharon, with Yasser Arafat, with Assad, all these agents of Soviet influence from the past that he'd somehow continued to maintain. So there were reports out there. I was certainly not the first person to uncover this. But I think in Austria, Schlaf did maintain a certain position and power, and certainly in business circles. He was known for his close ties with BAWAG, the Austrian bank, and certainly when the Israelis who were seeking to investigate him over allegations he'd given a bribe to Ariel Sharon. He wanted to create floating casinos in Israel, and he'd supposedly funneled some money to Ariel Sharon for this. And the Israelis, they had pretty much a lot of the evidence, but when they wanted to come to Austria to question Schlaf, the Justice Ministry stood in their way. And this meant that Martin Schlaf was a very, very influential person indeed.
I remember when I was Middle East correspondent and in the 90s, throughout the Oslo Accords process, Schlaf, actually the first thing was not offshore casinos, but a casino in Jericho that he set up together with the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli, the sons of Ariel Sharon. And it's quite interesting that we were reporting on this, but we never sort of got into a deeper investigative operation. And the same thing with the contacts in the coming out of the old Soviet network in Eastern Germany. And I think I have to take this on me and on my colleagues who are also here in the hall tonight to maybe sort of join the investigative journalism that you British journalists are just maybe a touch better than we are in?
I think it's only a question of having the time to do it. Unfortunately, I think when you're a journalist covering day-to-day news, you don't have the time to look into these things. And that's why it is so important to have and to support investigative journalism, because there's no way that I would have ever been able to dig into any of this had I not spent a whole 7 years writing a book.
It's very nice. This is a very good example of British politeness. One of my favorite characters in your book, of course, is Matthias Warnig, who you mentioned before. Because this, I think he is such a good example of what you're describing here. Having been in the Stasi already in Eastern Germany, meeting Putin at that point and emerging today as one of the, and for years now, on the center stage of Nord Stream 2. He, of course, is not the only one. You know, we have Gerhard Schröder and all these politicians. But Warnig is this crucial centerpiece in this entire operation. And if you look at it today, how we were now faced with the pipelines of Nord Stream 1 and 2 being clearly sabotaged in the last days. And of course, we don't know 100% the truth who did that. But I always wonder if it is thinkable that someone in this system that Warnig built up together with Putin on one side and people like Schröder on the other side, helped by all the governments, because everyone profited for the longest time in a very peaceful way also from it. Is it thinkable that Warnig and this whole group around him is sabotaging these pipelines that they have been building for years for billions?
I think some of them yes and some of them no, of course. I think what happened to the Nord Stream pipeline has a clear Russian connection. Of course, we have to wait for the results of a thorough investigation, but it only seems to make sense as this act of sabotage. It seems intended as another act of intimidation. We're meant to sit here and quake and say, oh my goodness, Putin's so crazy. He blew up the pipeline. What will he do next? When really, you know, Europe is already moving to replace a lot of the Russian gas supplies, and Germany in particular has done such a good job in doing that. I think I've heard from colleagues and from somebody who's worked very closely with Gazprom executives that many of them are tearing their hair out. Because it's precisely this. This is decades of work just going up in smoke. And this is even before the Nord Stream pipeline is blown up. Because by so openly blackmailing Europe over gas supplies, Russia has completely undermined its reputation as a reliable supplier of gas for decades to come. It's lost its biggest and most important market in Europe. And it's, even if it might puff about sending supplies to China, it's not going to be a big enough replacement, and it's going to take a very long time to build that additional pipeline capacity. So I have a source who's in contact with Gazprom executives, and they're deeply upset, just as many members of the Moscow elite have been upset, first by Putin's war, and of course by the strength of the Western sanctions, as they too see decades of work getting blown up in smoke. All the money they spent on their reputation, on paying libel lawyers to send anyone packing who wrote about their connections to Putin, that's all gone. They're sanctioned, they're also pariahs, and they're deeply upset about it.
I mean, it's so unbelievable to think that this is happening, that that they are blowing up their own work, literally, but also politically and economically. And I wonder if you could give us a sense, because on the one hand, Putin built up a kleptocracy And it was a big money-making machine, the Kremlin, in the last 22 years. And it started from the beginning. It started in the 90s, you describe it, in Petersburg. We know all these stories of the extra commissions that always went on the side to every deal, if it was small garbage men or big oil people. But I wonder if you think that the kleptocracy project always was also meant to be a political project to re-establish a type of Soviet Union superpower, because that was, after all, what Putin was from his character. He was an official of the secret service of the Soviet Union. So did one lead to the other, the kleptocracy to a superpower dream, or did they go together?
You know, I think we spent also many years in the West perhaps viewing the Putin regime through the wrong lens. We looked at it through our own eyes and through our own principles, or lack of them. When we saw Putin siphoning money for his allies, handing out inflated contracts to his closest cronies, such as Arkady Rotenberg and Gennady Timchenko, it looked like that he was doing so to help them, his closest allies, line their own pockets so that they could build mansions, yachts, or anything else that they wanted. But it didn't really make sense, because there's only so many tens of billions of dollars that you can spend on mansions and yachts. Why else were they doing it? And it seemed that in Russia, sort of having money, it's an expression of power. So when Putin was taking over all these cash flows for his closest allies, it was about accumulating power. I think, first of all, it was important to do that domestically. He needed to take over the country's most strategic cash flows, its oil companies, its metals companies. He needed to cow the oligarchs into serving him, into sharing their wealth with him, so that he would have a stash of cash to make sure elections in the Russian regions went his way, so that it would be this enormous state propaganda machine that was built. But I think at some point it kind of reached a critical mass. He'd been able to gather so much control over the economy through subverting the court system and basically signaling to any oligarch that they could face the same fate as Khodorkovsky if they put a foot out of line. That he could command so many tens of billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions by then. We've all heard people go on television and say Putin's a $500 billion man. And really, in many ways, he does own the whole of the Russian economy, because everyone now has had to follow his commands. But it wasn't really about Putin's personal wealth, because when he had created this critical mass of control domestically, he could then begin to use his command over those networks, that cash, the companies, to try and undermine markets here in the West, to try and undermine our democracies in the West. As I mentioned, the Yeltsin-era oligarchs will say that if they get a call from the Kremlin saying spend $1 billion or $2 billion on this or that strategic project, they can't refuse, they have to comply. So it became an exercise in not kleptocracy, but in creating power networks aimed at, unfortunately, corrupting and undermining our democracies. And this, again, it's unfortunately a facet of Putin's past. He could have tried to restore Russia's greatness, because this is what it was all about for him. Everything was about that moment in Dresden when he was trying to get backups from the nearby Soviet military base, and he'd been told Moscow is silent, and it seemed to him they'd given up their position, all their outposts of empire. All Putin wanted was to restore Russia's global standing. And he could have done so through trying to build a competitive and a vibrant economy. But unfortunately, he didn't know how to do that. So when he was taking control of all the country's cash flows, again, he was reverting to a KGB habit. He wanted to command these cash flows so that they could then be funneled very often through very obscure offshore companies, things called LLPs, LLCs, which have untraceable ownership, so they could then begin to influence our politics. It went into funding parties on the far left and the far right. We still have this curious example of Brexit, when we had the Vote Leave campaign funded by this gentleman called Aaron Banks, and yet the National Crime Agency has not been able to get to the bottom of where his money came from. He gave the largest ever political donation to the Vote Leave campaign. He gave £8 million. And when the National Crime Agency, tasked with looking into where this money came from, tried to look into it, they could get no further than the Isle of Man company that Banks part owned. They didn't have any jurisdiction to look any further than that. They just said, okay, this Isle of Man company loaned it to Aaron Banks. We can't look any further. So that money could have come from anywhere. And because Putin can command quite a lot of cash flow, it could have come from Russia. We just don't know.
I mean, I was in London throughout the Brexit campaign, and it seemed to me that, unfortunately, the British and especially the English public was critical towards the EU and critical enough to actually vote for Brexit by themselves, and so they did. So I never thought that the Russian influence made Brexit, but the clever bit of Putin's plans to destabilize the West, of course, was always to see where the weaknesses were and then funnel the influence through either money, but also through perks that he would give to far-right politicians in inviting them to Moscow. That, of course, happened in Austria also very much. And I always had the feeling that it wasn't so necessary here in Austria to bribe people, because the public was so pro-Putin anyway, so it was quite easy to just have political contacts on the highest level, and everyone was happy anyway. But the problem, of course, is that the Putin project now, with this war, runs into such a deep problem that escalation, on the one hand, is the biggest threat we see, but it might really be his demise in the end, because when I think of his psychology, and he was in Dresden in 89, and he saw how the Soviet Union, not the Soviet Union yet, but how the Berlin Wall fell, and all these thousands of people ran away to the West. And what we saw in the last week was the most astonishing thing, that thousands of people, men, tried to leave Russia because it is at war. And that must have felt for a president, if he got to see the pictures, but I guess that it's not possible for him, even in his isolation, not to see these pictures of 40 kilometers of cars standing at borders to forlorn places like Mongolia to get out of Russia, just not to serve in this war. So do you think that this is a déjà vu for him, where he will really feel that this is again the end of his empire that is approaching?
You know, I'm sure he doesn't want to admit that, but there was a very funny meeting that he had a few days before his great speech yesterday. He met with his old pal, Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus. And even Lukashenko, who's always been very much, he's not junior in age, but in terms of status, he's always been seen as junior. But he was sitting there and telling Putin, don't worry about those guys, just let them go. And this must have been very humiliating for Putin to be told from someone who's from a smaller country, shouldn't be seen as more powerful than him, trying to console him about the hundreds of thousands who fled Russia. So, you know, I think very much now, I think Putin has to realize, despite all the bluster of his speech yesterday, that his position is pretty fragile. And this is what I hear from the insiders in Moscow. You know, he never wanted to have to take the step of mobilization. He, in fact, promised his whole population when he launched the war that he wasn't going to do it. And yet here we are, 7 months later, all these men are getting called up. You know, this is, he's brought the war home in a way that's made it very real to a population that was just used to sticking its head in the sand about the worst excesses of Putin's rule, as long as it didn't interfere with their personal lives. That's no longer the case. And really, as I mentioned, like Putin's legitimacy, his standing among the elite, it's always rested on his popularity. And that's really now starting to quite rapidly fall, even though he has this enormous propaganda machine behind him that's been working almost unceasingly now for 20 years. Even the most popular and most rabid TV show hosts are starting to shake their heads rather in horror at what's going on. So, you know, I think we really have to see what happens now with the war, because these reservists, it's not going to be possible to train them. We've all seen the photos of what a shambles army they represent. There are some being sent there in flip-flops. They're being told to bring their own sleeping bags and all kinds of other equipment that the Russian army just can't even give them. We've seen the photos of them drunk in the fields or swaying across airports. And we have a very clever Ukrainian president, Zelensky, who is speaking about how, guys, if you want to actually survive, then just surrender. Will take good care of you. If I was a Russian man, I think I would take that offer up for sure. I think the BBC has done some reporting which shows that most of the men who are heading into Ukraine to fight, it's only really the over 50s who want to do any fighting. They're the ones who still feel the call of the Soviet fatherland and are nostalgic for that era. But no one else wants to go. So Putin has really put his own position in jeopardy. And I'm told by Moscow insiders that if the sending of the reservists there makes no material difference to the military position, that if Ukraine continues to take territory, then that's it. All bets are off. The infighting will begin to take over.
But if we look at now of the images we see, so on the one hand, and we had, for example, in Falter this week, I did a cover story where we spoke for days to people in Moscow and in Irkutsk and in Petersburg and in all the cities, if how they deal with the conscription and the mobilization. And it was, of course, one gave the other, and it's incredibly touching to speak to all these people who sound like my sons and say they want to go and study at university. They have no intention at all to go to this war. One of them who I interviewed called me now from Madrid and said he's out, he's on his way to Venezuela. I hope this will be okay for him there, we'll see. But on the other hand, of course, we have images from the Red Square yesterday after the annexation celebration, which is an outpour of fascist propaganda. And you wonder if all these people who are shouting there are paid. Because when we were correspondents in Moscow, we know how a lot of these demonstrations came together. I mean, people were put on buses in the provinces, brought to Moscow, shuffled out, and told to shout whatever. At that time, that was not fascism. That was sort of managed democracy under Putin. But now, of course, the stakes are higher, and I can imagine that many people are not being asked their opinion if they want to shout bravo or not. But on the other hand, there are, as we always say and hear from experts, around 30% of the population who are probably very much behind Putin. So what is your insight into these numbers?
The latest polling shows, and this is even according to the official poll data, that Putin's popularity has fallen 5% in the week since he launched the mobilization. So it's from 80% to 75%. And these are the official polls, which are clearly inflated, so they're not really to be believed. But the fact of the 5% drop, even under the state polls, is very, very telling. And yet more telling is the more pertinent question asked is, like, how many Russians actually want the war to continue? And that has gone from a majority to a minority. It's now 48%. And that's a very, very fast turnaround within a week.
Which is good. And that brings us to the infighting, the possibility of an uprising against Putin. It's not very probable that it will be a people's uprising at the moment because of the severe repressions. But in terms of your research into the Siloviki, into the people from the power ministries, the KGB, FSB power structures, the problem might occur that people who think that Putin should resign will be those who are more radical than him and who are not the ones who say, like, okay, it was a mistake, let's go back to the West, let's have a little negotiation and be nice and calm about it. It is more likely maybe that someone like, as you mentioned him before, Nikolai Patrushev, former FSB chief, sterner than Putin, might take over in order to retake the power and keep the club together.
You know, I'm afraid that this is another kind of ruse that they may try to frighten us with. And in fact, Putin, in sending reservists into Ukraine, in taking these much more extreme steps, is actually occupying that extreme niche now himself. There's not many more steps to take for any kind of much tougher leader. I think Putin now is that extremely tough and unrelenting leader that we've feared in the past. He's not pragmatic at all in any way. So I think probably what is more likely, and maybe this is too hopeful, but I think history repeats itself. When we saw the perestroika of the 80s, that was driven by progressive members of security services in foreign intelligence who saw that there was no way the Soviet Union could compete with the West in isolation. And I think there are members now of the security services and also, again, in foreign intelligence very much, who are horrified by Putin's war, and they're horrified by the sanctions and Russia's new status as international pariah. Many of them might have been willing to go along with it as long as maybe they could buy this ruse that Putin could maybe win in East Ukraine, India and China would be on board, so they could seek the opportunity to maybe turn around the global world order and so that they change global trade flows and that Russia would join with India and China while the West withered. That's already proving to be another fairy tale, because as we saw like 2 weeks ago in Samarkand, when Putin was meeting with Xi and with Modi, they made their concerns very, very clear. And China is no longer helping Russia so much evade sanctions. We've seen Turkey take steps to stop its own banks from helping Russia evade sanctions. And China's Xi was very worried. India's Modi expressed his concern very openly. And it's no longer the case that they can say, okay, we're going to redraw the world's trade flows, because it's just not happening. And instead, the Russian economy is withering. And so for these members of the security services, who really are patriots of their country, and they see themselves as essentially guardians of the country, and for them, Putin is now the main danger to stability. Another pillar of his presidency was that he was there as the guarantor of stability. And that stability no longer exists. And you have these centrifugal forces now unleashed, because very clearly the ethnic minorities are being targeted in particular for the call-up. We've seen all the protests in Dagestan. People are casting off their fear of imprisonment as a result of protests, because the other alternative is they get sent to the front where they're probably going to die. So he's really shaken every fundament in Russia's stability, which means I think more likely the threat to his position will come from within these progressive elements of the security services, who see that Russia needs to be integrated with the West in order to compete with us. It's not that they want to kowtow to the West. It's just more sane and more, it's you're able to compete if you actually have soft power networks here. And these soft power networks are also being undermined, because no one wants to be an apologist for the Putin regime anymore when he's so toxic.
I mean, when I reread your chapter now on how this series of suicides happened after in 1990, when sort of suddenly the KGB trustees who were entrusted with the Soviet money flows suddenly died one by one. They committed suicide. They sort of fell out of the window. And I read this now a few days again and realized what a parallel we are already seeing now before Putin's reign is over, but the signs are already there, because you have since January, when the war preparation was very obvious already to a lot of the business elite in Moscow, and people started suddenly dying. The ones who were a touch critical, or the ones who behind the scenes probably opposed any kind of preparations to this war. And so there's one oil company that spoke out against the war, Lukoil. Three of the top managers, one resigned, two died on 1st of September. A man called Ravil Maganov fell out of the sixth floor of a hospital in Moscow. And you think it is sort of a sign to a collapsing regime that the opponents, they don't even try to cover it up anymore. You know, they just die. So it is like in 1990 that people are trying to save the money flows, trying to grab what they can, kill people off who are opposing them. Is that what's happening? Is this the beginning of the end?
I mean, it's certainly the parallels that you raised are very clear. As you mentioned, there were a series of similar suicides, or so-called suicides, in 1991, just as the Soviet Union fell, just as the August putsch failed. There was the Nikolai Khrushchev, who was the head of the Communist Party's property department. He'd been charged with sort of overseeing the creation of an underground economy for the Communist Party. He'd overseen the transfer of billions of dollars of worth of the Soviet and the Communist Party's wealth into havens in the West. And because they knew the fall was coming, and like the KGB, they were trying to prepare for the fall. And yet, literally a day after the failed August putsch and the Communist Party was banned, Nikolai Khrushchev was found smashed on a pavement outside his apartment building. There was a note that he left saying, "I couldn't bear it." But, you know, but really he was the one who, he had all the keys to where all the money had been stashed away. And then literally a month later, his predecessor in that post was found dead in very similar circumstances. And then a month after that, the head of the American property department was found dead from falling out of a window too. So, it certainly seemed that these were the men who knew where the money was at a time of great turmoil and instability. And in Kruchina's case, it was the KGB who were really in control of the money flows, and Kruchina knew too much about where the money was stashed. So I think they couldn't afford to have him around. In the cases that you mentioned, all these oil executives, there was a senior executive from Gazprom Bank, which has always been known as a big kitty for the Kremlin. It funds most of its strategic operations. And then there was another executive from Novatek, which is owned by Gennady Timchenko, Putin's closest ally and crony from KGB days and from St. Petersburg. And he was found dead too. And Novatek, I think that's another key kitty for strategic operations. These aren't senior people, and I guess we haven't had the proper investigations yet, and I'm not sure we will for some time under Putin's regime. But it's certainly a sign either someone was nervous that they knew too much about the money flows, especially at a time of sanctions, or it was a sign of, you know, the pie, the economic pie is diminishing so much, money is so tight under sanctions that maybe they tried to pocket some for themselves, and there's the great division of wealth going on again, and it's turning out to be very, very violent indeed.
All this money stealing that then in the end turns out to be for nothing when a regime collapses, and it's just all these billions that are stashed away on Western bank accounts, now frozen and probably never to be enjoyed.
I'm sure the owners of those bank accounts will think differently about that. I'm sure somehow they're hoping that one day things will be different, these sanctions will be lifted, and they can access their wealth again. We see Roman Abramovich, for instance, he's been scurrying ever since the war began, trying to make sure he doesn't end up on the US sanctions list. He even got President Zelensky, with whom he's also maintained ties, to call up Joe Biden to say, please don't sanction Abramovich, because the fact is, Abramovich, even though he spent years denying it and threatening to sue or even suing journalists who dared to mention that he had a close relationship with Vladimir Putin, now he acts as Putin's official envoy in peace talks, or the peace talks that were going on before too many atrocities made them impossible. So his relationship with Putin is now bare for all to see. A leader of the Ukrainian delegation basically told the Wall Street Journal that, you know, now we tell Abramovich, go and tell your boss, meaning Putin, any details that they want to get ironed out. And yet Abramovich is now so desperate, he's willing to have this publicly acknowledged, just to avoid being on any more sanctions list. So I think we can certainly see this desperation in the members of this economic elite, especially those who made their fortunes before Putin came to power, the ones who made their money in the Yeltsin era. They're the ones who are most shocked and upset of all, because, you know, they were immensely rich and powerful before Putin came to power. After Putin came to power, you know, they had to share their wealth with the Kremlin. The boot was on the other foot. But they kind of thought, you know, we can bear this, you know, as long as we can continue to be fabulously wealthy and enjoy our riches and our power and have these reputations in the West and mix with the hoi polloi and the establishment here. But that now has been completely uprooted, and some of them have spoken about how shocked they are. And it's not just the ones who are already in the West. We've heard Oleg Deripaska, for instance. He's still in Moscow. He's been hit really hard by sanctions. His metals company is particularly vulnerable because it needs Western equipment in order to continue its production. And yet, he's been pretty brave. You know, he spoke out very openly just a few months ago. He said, I'm very concerned that we've given up all the achievements of the 90s and the 2000s. We're just sitting here waiting for victory. Victory for what? He said it would be a colossal mistake to destroy Ukraine. So you hear these voices now, and I think we'll hear them ever more now that Putin's position is vulnerable.
It's also very tricky. A lot of these businessmen, they were collaborating with Putin as long as the going was good.
Yeah.
And now suddenly nobody wanted to be his good friend anymore because they also fear that they will never get their funds back in the West. And it's, I think, a case-by-case study that also the Western governments will have to do to see what to do with Abramovich and Friedman and Deripaska and this whole generation of super rich men who, you know, have partly shady pasts, but also just the political, were too close to Putin, but also did a lot of legitimate business. So I'm not quite, do you have a sense what will happen with these funds? I mean, people would like to fund the reconstruction of the Ukraine with all this frozen money, but I think legally this is very, very difficult to imagine.
Yeah, for sure, because I think it's one thing to use the frozen funds of the state, the $300 billion in central bank reserves, for instance, to fund this reconstruction, and it's certainly another matter entirely to take somebody else's private property. And I think probably these funds had better remain frozen, and not we should not suddenly overturn our own principles and our own rule of law to throw money into Ukraine. I mean, some of them are begging now for sanctions to be lifted. We've heard that Friedman had offered to spend a billion, you know, I think he has 15 billion, so I'm sure he wouldn't miss it, on reconstructing Ukraine, if only the sanctions against him would be lifting. But I think we still have to be careful. As long as Putin is in power, as long as these guys still have businesses in Russia, still have relatives in Russia, they're vulnerable to the Kremlin. It means they still may be told to act on the Kremlin's orders. Mikhail Friedman, for instance, you mentioned, he still has Alpha Bank in Russia. This is a very key part of his business. He owns a huge retail chain there. These businesses are still operating, and if they are to continue to operate, then Friedman, to some degree, has to stay in Putin's good books. So, you know, with many of these people, we still don't know if they may spend their wealth here to cozy up to officials, to MPs, to try and get them to soften sanctions or pressure MPs and other leaders into saying, right, that's it, let's make Zelensky do a deal over Ukraine and all go home.
One of the curious cases of oligarchs who you describe or are being described to you in your book also as 100% Putin's men is Dmitry Firtash, who is still in Austria, as far as we know, since 2014, waiting for his extradition to America, where he's sought for fraud cases. And the Austrian government has not handed him over to the Americans. He now also gives interviews in sitting in Austria, saying that he's very much concerned about the Ukraine, where he's from, and that he's doing a lot to help his home country. But then again, of course, he was the one who profited a lot from the rather shady gas deals that Rosukrenergo brought him and a few other people who we already mentioned also before. Also Austrian banks involved, like Raiffeisen Bank. So there's a lot of murky business still to look into in Austria, but also, of course, in all the other European countries. And I wonder if you think that it is a decisive moment now for Western governments like the UK or the Austrian one to take this really seriously and not only sort of as a intermediate stage and will go back in the end just to take money when it comes because everyone likes a little extra cash in their real estate markets.
You know, I would hope that it would be difficult to be as naive as we have been in the past. Of course, the 90s and the 2000s were eras of great euphoria. It's when we did believe that it was a good thing to welcome as many Russians as possible and as many other kind of other rich billionaires, Chinese and others into our markets because, you know, there was nothing left for Russia to do but to integrate into our global markets and follow our orders. The more Russian companies listed on the listed London Stock Exchange, the better, because the more they'd have to follow our governance rules and transparency rules. But the fact that was that most of them were coming to London was because our rules were virtually non-existent. We had the so-called light touch regulation, you know, in which you know, you really didn't have to do very much at all in terms of transparency to list. So he had the likes of the Kremlin's Bank for Special Operations, VTB, making secondary share offerings in London and handing out massive fees to bankers and lawyers for arranging it and trying to pretend that this secondary share offering was going to in some way make them more independent. And it wasn't a majority stake they were selling. It was a very small amount. It was just making them more integrated here. And I think for so many years, you know, I think we just had this collective amnesia about what it might mean to have someone from the KGB running a country like Russia. What were the methods of coercion they could use? And I just think we forgot about all the tactics of the 70s and 80s when they could use front companies to funnel money into influence operations, when they were trying to sow chaos and disrupt the West, when they were even funding and supporting terror groups in Germany, the Middle East and elsewhere. I think we all thought, that's it, Cold War over, done and dusted, everyone's happy, all the billionaires, they want to be part of our Western capitalist system, that's it, we can all sit back and relax. And it was a great couple of decades, but I think anyone in London, for instance, who was accepting Russian money, or in Vienna, perhaps just thought, you know, maybe some of it's corrupt, but that, you know, that doesn't really matter, because you know, if it's corrupt cash, if a Russian is stealing from his own country, then it doesn't matter for us, because it just actually makes the Russian economy weaker. Why would it be a security threat? So you kind of forget that maybe some of the cash coming in has strings attached, that it's there to win influence, to win friends and influence people here in the West. And a lot of the cash was untraceable through these front companies. So a lot of it has been coming into our political system without us even being aware. And I think, you know, in the UK at least, I've seen a real sea change in people's perception since the war began. I think, yeah, Putin did literally tear off the mask. And the way that the Russian press now, I mean, the Western press, the UK press now writes about some of the Russian players in London. It's as different as night and day. People aren't scared to kind of write things in black and white how they are anymore. Whereas before, I think everyone was worried about litigation, for instance. A lot of these oligarchs had Western law firms who would go after any journalist who dared to question the source of their wealth. And now that's changed completely. So I think this era of naivety, I think it's over. And it's over for our energy markets too. I mean, who is going to forget this winter that we're facing now, when we know what the cause of much of it is, the spiraling inflation, the rising energy costs? It's because Vladimir Putin turned around and decided to blackmail the collective West. So I think it'd be very hard, or at least I hope it would be very hard, to return with the same open arms.
Let me just go back for a few minutes, because you said that the oligarchs didn't like people to write about what they did, and that concerned you in an incredible way, because they, when your book was published and it gained traction and people started talking about it. And it was not just one of these things that they could push away, but it was clear that you hit a nerve because you actually had really spoken to former collaborators who would talk about them, and you really put light on all these shady operations. And the oligarchs came after you with so-called slaps, sort of legal cases to shut you down. And can you talk about this a little bit? Because it must have been so incredibly difficult to get your publisher to back you up, to have your journalistic reputation not destroyed by an incredibly powerful legal assault, reputational assault by lawyers on you. How did that go? Because it went, you know, the book came out in 2020, and throughout the entire year of 2021, you were busy fighting in the courts.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. I never expected it because, you know, I thought I'd done my job and, you know, put all the questions to the protagonists, included their responses. You know, Roman Abramovich had come after us almost immediately after the book was published. He was very unhappy about the suggestion by three of his former associates that he'd bought Chelsea Football Club on Putin's orders in order to acquire soft power and influence in the UK. He was really upset about that. But we explained to his lawyers, we were like, look, we put these allegations to your spokesperson. The response, the denial, is included in the book. And that's it. We didn't hear anything from him for months, for 8 months to be precise. And then all of a sudden, nearly a year after publication of the book, suddenly he's making a press statement to everyone that he's going to go ahead and sue me personally and the publishers over this and a number of allegations in the book, which he said were completely false. Of course, I have no relationship with Vladimir Putin, though we know now that to be very, very true. He said these claims are very damaging to me and I'll take you to court. That was already pretty shocking. But then when in the weeks that followed, one after the other, we had Mikhail Friedman, Pyotr Avin, some other incredibly wealthy Russians, and then Alisher Usmanov, who threatened to go ahead and sue, but then never did. And then we had Rosneft, the Kremlin oil champion. And we had another guy called Shalva Chigirinsky, who suddenly emerged at the very end out of the blue and said he wanted to sue me too. It was incredible. I had, you know, It was completely overwhelming. I mean, it was already one thing to be facing a lawsuit from someone like Abramovich, who's incredibly wealthy and powerful. But when you have all this, like five of them ganged up against you, you know, I didn't know if the publisher was going to be able to afford to defend the book. You know, I spent 7 years working on it, you know, and I kind of spent a really long time. I wasn't working full time. It was really difficult. I'd taken a lot of time out of my career to do it. And now I was thinking, oh my God, it's going to have to be withdrawn from the shelves because this is too much. No publisher is going to be able to afford to defend it. And yet I was very lucky because the lawsuits kept coming, and yet HarperCollins said, nope, it's okay, we'll defend you, we'll take this on. And they had a brilliant team of lawyers, and we managed to fend off the lawsuits. In the end, Rosneft, the Kremlin oil champion, they had to withdraw its suit because in a preliminary hearing, the judge basically said it has no merits. It's not what I wrote was not defamatory of the company. That essentially, yes, it was a suit designed to intimidate and pressure HarperCollins out of defending the book. And then with Mikhail Friedman and Arvin, who were barely in the book to start with, there were maybe two or three lines about them. And yet when we hadn't heard any complaint from them until a year after publication, when suddenly they stood up and said how damaging it was. I'll tell you what Friedman was complaining about, and it was completely overblown and exaggerated. He said, because I wrote that he had worked with KGB in the late 80s to trade commodities, that he'd had support. He had to have support from the KGB in order to do so. We quoted a former government official about this, and also a former director for Russia on the National Security Council in the United States about how all these guys, anyone in the 80s who was trading commodities, had to have support from the KGB in order to do so. And Friedman said, even though I'd written this, and I've written nothing about him almost under Putin, apart from that he stayed clear of politics and he merged his oil company with BP. That was it. That was the only mention of Friedman in my book about him under the Putin regime. And yet he said that because I wrote about him possibly having backing from the KGB in the 80s, which he denied, he said, this means that I am part of Putin's, you wrote that I am part of Putin's KGB capitalism working to undermine democracy across the globe. And my book had made no such mention of him. So it's just an example of how these guys would exaggerate their claims and to try and frighten the publisher out of defending the book. So there was one like that from him and then from Arvin, and we made some very small changes. And with Abramovich, we had a very good judge in a preliminary hearing, and she again said that he was making an exaggerated claim. He said that the book said he had a corrupt relationship with Vladimir Putin. And I could have tried to write that, but I didn't. And the judge said that actually what the book said was that he's under Vladimir Putin's control. And this is something that was much, much harder for him to dispute, given all the reporting in the book, everything that we know about his regime, and it's certainly impossible for him to dispute now. So instead, we got an offer from the lawyers. So after spending, HarperCollins spent £1.5 million defending my book from five claims last year. It was just, you know, it's horrible to even think of. The UK law system is so costly, and the way that the system is stacked against you from the start, because only a rich billionaire can afford these type of lawsuits, and journalists certainly can't. And yet, so after all this with Abramovich, if we continued to fight Abramovich, it would have cost us another £2.5 million at least in the UK. And it could have cost at least the same amount in Australia, because not only had he sued us in the UK, he'd filed the exact same suit in Australia, even though he has no business there. He has no reputation to protect, and the book wasn't even published there. It was just distributed. So we said this was an abusive process, again, to intimidate HarperCollins out of defending us. But because HarperCollins was facing these massive costs, we agreed to a settlement offer. So Abramovich's lawyers, instead of demanding, we deleted absolutely everything in the book that he didn't like, including bits where he wasn't even mentioned. There was a quote from Joe Biden when he was vice president, in which he was talking about how the Kremlin uses oligarchs as kind of weapons or tools of corruption in the West. And he even objected to that, even though his name wasn't mentioned, and he wanted us to delete that passage. But thankfully, he calmed down, because he realized things weren't going his way. So instead of deleting things, for instance, on the Chelsea Football Club case, after £1.5 million of costs, what we changed was very, very tiny. Instead of quoting the three former associates as saying that Putin ordered Abramovich to buy Chelsea Football Club in order to acquire soft power and influence in the UK, we now say, according to the three former associates, Putin may have asked him to acquire Chelsea Football Club in order to acquire soft power and influence. And then there's an addition to a denial that was already there. So it's crazy. But there's a good silver lining to the whole affair, because that is, you know, I was completely overwhelmed and sort of taken aback by all the support that I got from journalists. I think the Kremlin really did overreach in this case, because it was so obvious, the intimidation that lots of journalists were writing in support. And I think the UK government really stood up and took notice too. And now they are going to reform UK libel laws to make it harder for these types of abusive cases designed to intimidate and harass journalists to be happening again. There are going to be mechanisms in place which allow such type of lawsuits, which you call a SLAPS, a strategic litigation against public participation, when essentially deep-pocketed individuals are using their wealth to try and shut down journalism that's in the public interest, that these type of cases can be just thrown out to a much earlier stage. So in some ways, you know, it was a lot of pressure, but I'm quite glad, and I almost wouldn't have had it any other way. But yeah, I'm deeply grateful to my publishers for standing by me.
All the oligarchs that sued you, all the companies that sued you, are now under Western sanctions. So you won, basically, because your truth has prevailed, as far as we can see.
Sie hörten die britische Aufdeckerjournalistin Catherine Belton in einer Wiener Vorlesung mit der Journalistin Tessa Schischkowitz am 1. Oktober 2022. Bei den Organisatoren, den Wiener Vorlesungen und dem Institut für die Wissenschaften von Menschen bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Aktuelle Analysen und Reportagen zum Ukraine-Krieg aus der Ukraine und auch aus Russland lesen Sie jede Woche im Falter. Wenn Sie kein Heft vergessen wollen, ist ein Abonnement der beste Weg. Alle Informationen dazu gibt es im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Sendung.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.